Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is my colleague, Joe Healy. And we will not be joined by an interview guest today. We are pausing the campus or the clubhouse conversations series for a week so that we can talk about the ranking of the top transfer classes that came out at baseballamerica.com. Joe did the work on that one. And so we're going to dive into all things transfer classes, which schools had the best ones this summer. We're going to dive into that today on this edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. If you are not subscribed yet to the podcast, you can find us on all of your favorite podcasting apps, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you find the podcast, hit that follow or subscribe button. And we come at you week throughout the off season. Typically, we're doing our clubhouse conversation series where we bring on a guest from the college baseball world to chat about their team. We've had Jim Schlossnagel, Dave Van Horn, John Scheff. Last week was Wake Forest ace Rhett Lauder. So we've already had some great guests. You can find those in the archives. We'll have some more great guests in the weeks to come. This week, though, like I said, we're focusing on transfer classes. And Joe, as we do so, we're just coming out of the Labor Day weekend. And, colleges have been back in session for a while now, for the most part. But, I feel like that's kind of the cultural moment. Like, school is back now because we're past Labor Day.
No doubt about that. I always thought it was funny when I was a kid. I don't think we started absurdly early. My school's growing up, but we kind of tended to start around like August. I always think of August 19th because one of my best friends all throughout school, his birthday was August 19th, and his birthday occasionally would fall on the first day of school. So that's kind of when we started. It was always kind of a weird deal where you'd get, a couple of weeks in and then you'd have a holiday, which,
did that kid get cake? Like, did you get cupcakes on his birthday?
I don't really remember. I don't, certainly not at school. I don't remember it as his parties or what it was, but not at school. Should he have?
I'm thinking more like if your birthday falls on the first day of classes, how would your teacher handle that? And it sounds like his teachers just ignored it.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, we became friends. He moved to our area like in fifth or sixth grade, so like by the time he was kind of at an age where the teachers were kind of doing less of that kind of stuff. If we had been friends in first grade or second grade, maybe it's a different story, but not that your birthday should not be celebrated as you get into your adolescent and teenage years, because it should, but it's just kind of different. So but his party was often like the weekend before school started, which always has like that. I don't know about you, but I this will not probably not shock certainly not shock Teddy, and maybe not even our listeners who have been listening to me for several years now. But I was always that kid that had a hard time if I was at a part like a, his birthday party or some other kind of event the weekend before school started. I had a hard time having fun because I was just so burdened by the fact that I had to go back to school next week. I just always had a really hard time with that. So probably not the best way for young Joe to have lived his life, but it was what it was.
These things happen, I suppose.
No doubt. No doubt. I remember one time, I have a very vivid memory. I may have told this story before, and if so, I apologize. Very vivid memory being at the Houston Zoo with my dad and my stepmom and my grandfather and my two younger siblings. It was mostly for them at that point because I was at an age where I still liked the zoo, but I was like probably in middle school. So like I'm kind of past the like prime age for the zoo. But anyway, I'm there. And I had done the math in my head to figure out where exactly was the midpoint of the summer. And I remember sitting on a bench with my grandfather while my younger siblings were off doing something and we were like eating ice cream or something. And I looked at him and I was like, today is the midpoint of summer. It's all downhill from here. And he just kind of was like, well, that's a terrible way to look at it. Like, but that's what it was.
I'm glad you did that math.
It's about the only math I was good at, I guess.
All right, well, let's get into some rankings math. That's some math that we're pretty good at here at Baseball America. Transfer class rankings is something that we only have been doing for a couple of years now, because it wasn't really relevant prior to the existence of the transfer portal. And now, obviously, very relevant over the last 2 years as the one-time transfer exemption has been put into place by the NCAA. This year, LSU brings in the number one transfer class. That's no surprise if you listen to whatever episode it was a few weeks ago when we talked about the most impactful transfers in college baseball, as LSU brought in both number one and number two on that list. So yeah, definitely no surprise that LSU ranks number one, Joe. But you know, we've talked a lot about Tommy White and Paul Skeens. Obviously, those two are all Americans. That's a big part of the reason why LSU is number one. But do we want to get a little deeper into the class here? Not that you need to go much deeper to find a Thatcher Hurd. He just was injured for a lot of this year, and that's probably why he wasn't an All-American as well. But they do have more than just White and Skeens.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, Hurd, it's easy to forget now, but Hurd was trending towards maybe being the best freshman arm in the country when he went down with injury. I mean, his numbers at the time he went down are just an absurd, a 106 ERA in 34 innings, and the stuff was really good and all of that. So he's obviously, you know, if he's healthy, and that's the big question. I mean, all signs point towards him being healthy and ready to go, but assuming that's the case, like, UCLA could have, you know, that could be your Friday guy right there. And then it's been kind of funny to me throughout this process that, you know, Christian Little almost feels like a throwaway a little bit in this class, just because, or like an extra throwaways too, but like just in like an extra in this class. But the reality is a couple things. One, I think Christian Little, we may have talked about this before, I think he's kind of hurt by the fact that his perception is hurt by the fact that he came in with such fanfare, right? Like, graduated early to go to Vanderbilt, and, you know, he started a game in the CWS in 2021 and kind of thought that maybe last year would have been the year he'd pop as a sophomore. And while that didn't quite happen, you look at the numbers and they're mostly fine. Like, they're not, don't get me wrong, he hasn't taken that kind of big leap that I think some people might have seen coming at some point, but he's been fairly effective in his time at Vanderbilt, and the stuff is quite good. You know, touched 98 with his fastball last year and has four different pitches, and now he's getting to work with Wes Johnson, you know, by all accounts, one of the best pitching coaches in the game. So, I mean, he's a guy that ceiling is incredibly high on him. And I think the floor is pretty high too. Like, if he's simply the type of reliever he was last year at Vanderbilt, that's a pretty good piece. Like, he wasn't bad last year. Again, it's just, I think there's just a perception working against him because of what he was as a prep player. And so that tells you how good this class is. I mean, they have three of the top five transfers in the country. Christian Little's the kind of the fourth big piece of that group. But the ceiling, both, he has significant floor and ceiling, I think, there. And that's, I mean, he's the type of guy that would be a centerpiece of a lot of other transfer classes around the country. But LSU's is so stout that that's kind of what he ends up being. And the fifth guy here is Ben Nippold, who was a late add to the class from VCU. VCU obviously made a late coaching change in the summer. And so a bunch of VCU guys, there's a couple of them going to Mississippi State and various other places. But you know, he ends up late in the process. LSU lost a couple of pieces transfer pieces. I'm struggling with my words there, but lost a couple of transfer pieces like in the draft and what have you. So there were some spots there, and Ben Nippold took one, and high on base infielder, .430 on base last year, walked more than he struck out. He also can play anywhere on the dirt, basically. And I think there's value there for LSU, whether or not he's a key offensive piece. Like, I don't know. I think the value there for the Tigers is probably more so that he's got the defensive versatility, especially in light of some of the defensive questions that LSU is going to have, whether it's, what do you do with Tommy White, or, you know, how solid is Jordan Thompson going to be on the infield? Maybe he's a guy who could, you know, be someone to at least fill a part-time role there to give them a little bit more of a steady hand defensively. So that's kind of, I feel like, just a true depth piece in this class. But again, a guy who was very successful at a good VCU program last year. And it just speaks to how good this class is overall, that he really truly does just feel like a depth piece.
One of the other things about Christian Little is that he is just 19. He turned 19 like 2 months ago. He'll pitch the entire season as a 19-year-old. And sometimes I felt like we spend a little too much time talking about Christian Little's age, and sometimes I feel like we don't spend enough time talking about his age when we talk about expectations versus reality and everything. Like, he enrolled early. And a lot of times when you see guys do that anymore, it just feels like they're doing it and they're getting themselves back to the class that, like, is more age appropriate. He was not doing that. he straight up, like he was a normal age for his class, and then he went to college a year early. And if anything, he might have been on the younger side of his class. He doesn't turn 20 until next July. So there's the point of that is there's still a lot of room for growth for him. And, you know, he'll be the same age as some of the incoming freshmen. And he has 2 years of experience. So, Vanderbilt, players that have transferred from Vanderbilt, even high profile ones, have often not gone on to find incredible success elsewhere. We'll see if Little bucks that trend. And there are reasons to see why he might be one of those players that does kind of buck that trend. But, for the most part, Vanderbilt has not had, like, they have players transfer out. It happens, but it hasn't happened where you look around and you're like, oh, well, that guy, why did Vanderbilt like give up on him? You know, it happened, you know, someone like Malloy at Georgia Tech, he had a really nice season for Georgia Tech, got himself drafted, but it wasn't like, oh, well, there's an All-American that Vanderbilt lost. So I'll be interested to see that one. But I mean, this class is so deep, despite, you know, it's only five players. We'll talk about classes that are larger than that. But this, just the pure talent, the depth piece of it, it's all really there for LSU, and an easy decision for you at number one this year.
No doubt. There was never a thought here. There's a pretty big gulf between LSU and Arizona State, which is a very good class, but there was a gulf there, which is impressive on a number of levels. Not the least of which, by the way, being that LSU didn't need this class, right? I mean, they return a pretty good team led by, you know, Dylan Cruz, the best college prospect in the game. They've returned a good team. They're bringing in like an incredible traditional recruiting class. Like, they could have just not taken any transfers and probably would have been in pretty good shape. So in some ways, this transfer class is just like, there are teams we will talk about here where you look at them and go, okay, they needed this transfer class, whether it was because they weren't very good last year and need to kind of reboot the roster, or because this is just a year-to-year strategy this program uses, the transfer portal. There are some of those. LSU didn't need it, and they still pulled in a class like this, which I think makes it all the more impressive, because it's not like they were selling, like, yes, Tommy White's going to be in, Paul Skeens and Hurd, and they're going to be a big part of plans right away, but it's not like they were one of those teams that could go into the transfer portal and sell like all this playing time and all this opportunity. Like, no, you have to be an All-American type of player in a lot of cases for LSU to be like, yes, there's all kinds of opportunity for you to come in and be a star right away. But that's precisely what they brought in. We're all, for the most part, all American level talents.
So you said there's a big gap between LSU and Arizona State, which is number two. Tennessee is number three. Tennessee has maybe more, like it is a smaller class than ASU. This is one of the challenges of ranking recruiting classes, but even more so in transfer classes, is that there are all different sizes that these things come in. ASU brought in like, I don't know, a dozen players, and Tennessee is much more carefully selecting a class than that. So that's a challenge, obviously, but how tight was it between Arizona State and Tennessee and whoever else you consider it to?
Yeah, so I think it's LSU, Gulf, Arizona State, smaller but still sizable gulf, and then Tennessee. Now, that's an interesting philosophical debate, but I think Tennessee is closer to Mississippi State and TCU and Kentucky behind them than they are necessarily Arizona State. And the reason being is just with a class that small, it's just hard, you know. Now, the fact that they have a four-person class, because they also brought in a starting pitcher, Andrew Lindsay, who didn't pitch last year but was a weekend guy at Charlotte a couple of years ago. But the three star pieces here for Tennessee are Maui Ahuna from Kansas, Griffin Merritt, the American Conference Player of the Year from Cincinnati, and Zane Denton, who's been the middle of the order bat for Alabama the last 2 years. Those are all guys who were ranked in the top 20 of the top 100 transfers rankings. And it's on the strength of that they're ranked number three. but there was still a pretty big gulf there between them and Arizona State at two, because it's just, there is risk with a class that small. Like I don't have any doubts about Maui Ahuna, and I really don't have any doubts about any of the three, but because they're all ranked in the top 20. But if one of those guys misses and just isn't the same type of player, or injuries that inevitably happen to this group of players, like that class is going to fall apart a little bit because it's just so small, right? Arizona State just kind of shopped the whole store. It's kind of the difference between, like, you know, you go going shopping at Kroger and what you kind of get for your money versus going it to Whole Foods and getting what you get for your money, right? Like Arizona State went to the grocery store and shopped the entire thing. Like they've got, and the team, this is a team we talked about, like that just wasn't very good last year. And so they knew they needed a little bit of a reboot, and boy, are they getting one. I mean, it reminds me, and you know, and they certainly hope it gets the same kind of result, but it reminds me a little bit of A&M's recruiting class last year, where it was just like, they're going after players who are going to impact the next season's team. You know, a guy like Luke Keyskull, or who's going to be a guy at the top of the order and start at shortstop more than likely, and Ross Dunn, who could be the Friday night guy right away from Florida State. And then they're also going to go and get Nick McClain, who was a highly touted recruit at UCLA last year and didn't play because of injury, or Drake Varnado from Arkansas, who, again, highly touted recruit who just didn't get a lot of time last year with the Razorbacks. And those are more pieces for, yes, if they're great in 2023, that's what they're shooting for. But also those guys are going to be around for 2024. And so those are kind of building pieces. And A&M did some of that too, right? So again, not predicting they have the same level of success with it, but they are trying to do a similar thing, which is like, let's use this to give us a better team immediately and also just a better program moving forward. And so the size of the ASU class just made it to where I couldn't put Tennessee ahead, even though on the aggregate, you know, Tennessee has nearly as good a class when you consider the star power. And that kind of, as we move forward in this conversation, that's something to think about as a listener here, is that I tended to, yes, there are some big classes ranked in the top 10. I can't ignore the size of a class like Arizona State or Kentucky or Mississippi State, but you want that star power in your class, right? If two of the three of Ahuna, Merritt, or Denton end up being all Americans or just all SEC type players, like you want that versus a class of 12 people having produced, you know, four or five regulars and one or two guys who are cornerstone pieces. Like you just want the star. You'll take the star power over the depth any day of the week. And so I tended to lean a little bit more on high end in the transfer classes. But I can't ignore the volume. And in this case, the difference in the volume was just too great for me, especially when you consider that, oh, by the way, you know, Arizona State has two top 10 guys too. And Keyskull and Ross Dunn were both top 10 transfers. So it's not like they don't have the quality there either, right? So you combine that with the depth, and that's what ends up putting it over Tennessee. The debates for me started to get really interesting when you talk Mississippi State at four, TCU at five, you know, Kentucky at six. That was a pretty tight cluster there. Because it really is trying to predict. Those are three pretty big classes, and it's just trying to predict which of these guys end up being cornerstones for the respective teams, all of whom are in major conferences and who have, you know, Omaha type aspirations. And in Kentucky's case, just trying to get back to the postseason, which of these guys in these classes are going to be stars and which of these guys are going to be depth pieces. And that's kind of tough. That's kind of ultimately what you're trying to do to find differences in them.
One of the things that doing the re-ranking of recruiting classes, once the players have matriculated through college, one of the things that exercise has taught me is just how few difference makers like actually tend to come in any one class. Like most teams are bringing in at least a dozen players, new players every year. Like if you have a roster of 35, like some attrition, plus some seniors, depending on like what level of program we're talking about, there's also some draft. And all of that means that you're bringing in 10 to 15 players every year. Some schools bring in more, whatever, but average probably 10 to 15. Even the best schools, like when I go through and I list like, all right, so here are the All-Americans, and then here are the other players from this class that really, like, you know, were regulars, made a real impact on this program. Like once you get outside the top, like half dozen or so maybe even top 10 classes. The rest of that top 25, like, you're looking at like 3 to 5 players basically that have been like real true impact types. And so like that's why when Joe does the transfer rankings, when I do the recruiting rankings, that we're looking at like, okay, who has the star power? Because getting those pieces, like having a bigger class, having more volume means you have more bites at the apple to find a star. But if you have the bigger deal guys coming in, like that is like a natural guiding light because those players are as rare as they are.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's easy to focus on kind of the depth, but really you're looking at, you know, you're trying to get in a big class, whether it's recruiting or transfer, you're trying to get one superstar, a couple guys you could call stars. And then if you get a couple of productive players out of the rest, you're doing pretty well. And, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting about this group, by the way, just as I kind of like wrap up my thoughts on the high end of this list, is you see, first of all, the SEC prominence. And when people ask, like, you know, who's benefiting from the transfer portal, it's clear the SEC has cleaned up in this regard. You see teams that just kind of, the transfer portal is what they do, right? It's only been a couple of years, but I think we can say confidently that the transfer portal is just going to be part of Kentucky's strategy moving forward. And I talked to Nick Mingione about that a little bit for the piece I wrote about what it's like to work in the transfer portal for coaches this summer. And, you know, he's pretty open about like transfer portal's opportunity, you know, opportunity for players, opportunity for programs. Like there's just opportunity there. So clearly they see value there. But then outside of that, you see Arkansas is in the top 10 and they don't take as big, the big classes. All this one's a little bit bigger than the ones they've taken in past years. Their classes aren't as big, but they tend to do a very good job of like, okay, where do we have holes? And then who can we put in those holes immediately? They tend to be pretty good at finding fit. So they're there. But then there's a couple of teams that really weren't necessarily this kind of transfer portal heavy in the past that I think you can look at and understand they're trying to pull off some reboots. And one of them is Mississippi State at number 4, like just a team that really struggled last year. We've talked about that quite a bit. And so they were a team that has dabbled in the portal, right? Like they've had some nice depth pieces through the portal, but they went a little bit harder in the transfer portal than they have in the past. And I think tried to pull out some more foundational guys for the 2023 team. And the other one was South Carolina. And South Carolina had a ranked transfer class last year, but it wasn't like this. It was, you know, a small handful of guys. And that worked in some cases and didn't work in others. But this is more of a whole hog situation, although I guess whole hog would describe more Arkansas. But this is definitely like a shopping the whole store situation for South Carolina. They were looking for a little bit of everything in the transfer portal, and they seem to mostly have found it because it is a pretty diverse group of guys who do different things and have different skills and play different positions. But it's always interesting, especially at the top of these transfer classes, transfer rankings, to think about the motivations behind why a team went the way they did in transfers. And I think there's some commonality there with some of what you see in the top 10 are teams that either A, it's just a part of their larger recruiting strategy, or B, knew that, hey, if we're going to be better in 2023, like we need to hit the reset button pretty hard. And the transfer portal is a way to do it.
All right, we're going to take a break here and we'll be back with some more transfer talk here in a second. All right, Joe, I want to talk a little bit more about some of these bigger classes. So, I mean, we're talking ASU, we're talking Mississippi State, we're talking South Carolina. I don't really want to talk A&M. They don't really fit the broader question here. I guess we can also talk Kentucky. These are teams that are all trying to reset. They missed the tournament last year. You can throw Missouri in. Anyone else that I haven't mentioned. Bigger class, team that missed the tournament last year. Who was actually going to be successful at it? We saw what Auburn and A&M did last year, missed the tournament, brought in some key transfers, ended the year in Omaha. I'm not asking you to pick which one of these teams is going to Omaha, but which one of these teams is going to be much better than anyone realizes right now or is expecting just based on what you would traditionally look at in terms of, well, they weren't very good last year, so like how much of an improvement are they going to make this year?
So which teams did you give me there to choose from just to make sure I don't take someone off the board?
Hale State, South Carolina, Arizona State, Kentucky, if you're into Missouri. Really anyone that missed the tournament last year and has a larger class is what I'm looking at here. So like not an A&M, like they have a bigger class, but like they're going to be good next year. We know that.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. So I kind of like from a, so let me,
I guess also though, if somebody has a bespoke class that is going to change the fortunes of the program, like I'm into hearing about that too. I just find that to be less likely.
Yeah, for sure. Like, so I actually really like, just this is not an option you gave me, but let me throw a couple of just other little side things out here. I really like TCU's class, not a team that did a lot of this last year, and they even lost the best piece of it. Cade Morris ended up staying at Nevada, and he could have been, you know, he could have been the ace of the staff. But I really like Austin Davis as a defensive player, good on base guy, Trey Richardson, athletic middle infielder, Hunter Hodges, maybe the nastiest reliever on the Cape this past summer, Sam Stoutenboro, veteran starter, Ryan Vanderhye, whose stuff is better than his numbers at Kansas. Like it's a pretty good class. So like that doesn't quite qualify, but like, I just wanted to kind of shout out that like, hey, this is a new entrant into kind of this space. I will also give a shout out here to Arizona State. They're not the answer to the question because I don't know how much better they're going to be. I will just say that the on-ramp to being improved is a little bit easier in the Pac-12. So if you told me Arizona State is, you know, they were a team that finished eighth in the Pac-12 last year, if you told me that they're third or fourth in the Pac-12 and a solid regional team, like I would 100% buy that. But I'm going to throw them out because I don't think that's quite the right way to look at that. So to answer your question more honestly, I think Mississippi State is the team to look at here. Because I think when you look at transfers, I think it's important when you're trying to gauge impact, I think it's important to look at the profile of what we know has been successful when it comes to transfers. And we don't have a lot of data here, so this we could reevaluate this in 2 to 3 years and get a completely different answer. But there is a pretty long track record at this point of if a player is a mid-major player or just a smaller, you know, because they have a guy, Landon Gartman from Memphis, right? That's not really a mid-major, the American Athletic Conference, but like, you know what I mean, a smaller program. If they put up numbers there and they are good enough athletically and skill-wise that the coaches at an SEC program or Big 12 or ACC, whatever you want to throw in there, goes, that guy can play in our league, bet I'm confident betting on that guy. So when you look at Landon Gartman, who held opponents to a 175 average last year at Memphis and had a 356 ERA, like if they think he can pitch in the SEC and he put up numbers last year as a freshman, mind you, in a pretty good conference, that's a guy it seems like you should bet on. And Connor Husak at shortstop for the VCU, again, a regional team, you know, and he showed like a dynamism with some power and some speed. If they think he's athletic enough to play in the SEC, okay. Like Colton Ledbetter of Samford is coming off of a massive summer, and it feels like maybe they got a real bargain with him. He put up numbers at Samford, not Sonny DeShera kind of numbers, but good numbers at Samford last year. Again, some power, some speed, and then had a really good summer. And it feels like, okay, he might actually be a guy who's just super ready to be an impact piece in the SEC. Amani Larry from New Orleans, again, dynamic middle infielder. Like he reminds me a little more of like a Scotty Dubrul type of player, maybe. Maybe more of a role player as opposed to middle of the order, top of the order kind of guy. But long story short, their class feels most like the types of guys that we have seen time and time again have success in a transfer situation. Some of these other classes have a little more prospecting, and I don't mean prospecting in terms of like MLB draft, although that, I guess that's kind of also true. But you know, you look at Kentucky's class, and they do have some proof here. Kendall Yule is a long track record at Eastern Kentucky. Ryan Waldschmidt, I think, is actually probably like a guy who's going to be known in the prospect world. He probably already is, but they're also, they've got guys like, you know, that are a little more betting on potential, like Zach Heiss from Missouri, who's got good stuff but didn't really necessarily put up numbers at Missouri. You know, Jackson Gray, who had a bad year at Western Kentucky last year but was good the year before. So which version of him are you getting? Or Ryder Giles, who can play a good defensive shortstop and can kind of pitch, but like he was never a star at ECU. So with their class, like there's a little bit more of like projecting and maybe they're just fitting more roles, and that's all valid, but there is some betting on some potential there. And it's the same way with South Carolina, right? Like they're bringing in Gavin Cassis, who is a highly regarded guy going to Vanderbilt who just didn't get much chance to prove himself at Vanderbilt, or Roman Kimball from Notre Dame, who has good stuff and had just kind of so-so numbers last year. Or Clemson guys like Dylan Brewer or Jonathan French, who have potential but didn't really necessarily show it at Clemson. And so they're betting on kind of unlocking some guys. And I just don't think there's that level of uncertainty when you look at Mississippi State's class. We've seen guys with those types of profile have success. And it's frankly part of the reason why, like, yes, they just have more players ranked in the top 100 than any other program. And that's the reason they're ranked four here. But also there is just I have a higher level of comfort with the profiles of the types of players they're bringing in from the transfer portal. I have a higher level of confidence that that's actually going to lead to the kind of reboot they're looking for, on top of the fact that they continue to recruit well and all that stuff is still also true.
One more question from me. Florida is number 10. They have Hurston Waldrop. That's the best pitcher in the portal. They have two other players, which is Schiekhofer and Dale Thomas, who are more, like, especially Schiekhofer, kind of a depth piece. Dale Thomas will probably play some sort of role. Hard to know precisely. Class is based a lot around having Hurston Waldrop, though. How good does Hurston Waldrop have to be for you to feel like you were wrong to rank them 10th?
How good does he have to be that they should have been higher, is what you're saying?
Correct.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, frankly, the reason they're not higher is just I would have liked to have seen more than three players here, right? I mean, like, they had Colby Thomas, dynamic outfielder from Mercer, and he got drafted and signed. You know, if they have him, we're probably looking at a class more similar to Tennessee. It's probably closer to 5, 6, maybe even higher. They're one that was really, really tough. I had the same questions I had about Tennessee, frankly. If he's all SEC good, like, I'm going to feel like, yeah, they should have been. And that's frankly right in the, you know, right in the wheelhouse of what Hurston Waldrop could be. If he's all SEC, challenging to be all American, it's going to feel like, yeah, they should have been quite a bit higher, which is, you know, this is some of the risk you take ranking this stuff, is that you do have to balance, you know. But then again, like, it's the same argument for Tennessee. If he's just kind of okay, like, 10's going to seem kind of rich for them, right? Because then Dale Thomas is like a nice player and Richie Schiekhofer is maybe a fourth outfielder or something, you know, spot starter. Maybe he comes into more playing time than that. But, you know, if Hurston Waldrop is just kind of what Brandon Sproat was last year, which is very good, then it's like, okay, maybe 10 was correct, or maybe he was even a little bit high. So, but his potential is certainly much greater than that. You know, he and Brandon Sproat are, you know, best 1-2 punch in the SEC, perhaps. Like, that's, you know, there's a high level of probability that it looks like, just on the strength of him alone, should have been quite a bit higher. That's for sure.
Yeah, entirely possible that was the hardest ranking that you had to deal with here, is how to deal with Florida. The full 20 or 25, however the class is joined, the full 25 is available over at baseballamerica.com. Make sure to check it out there. Joe, did you have any parting thoughts, any teams that just missed that you wanted to shout out?
Yeah, it's a good idea to shout out some of the just misses, because one thing that I noticed about this was a lot harder this year. Like, last year, trying to get to 25, I didn't have to work that hard to get to 25, but there were definitely some classes at the back of the 25 that I was just like, so shout out Notre Dame and Clemson, who had smaller classes, but both had two players ranked in the top 100. They were both in the mix. Long Beach State has an interesting class, and they lost some guys, right? Juwan Watts Brown, most notably. But they bring in an interesting class of, like, some proven guys from lower levels. And that was kind of an interesting class to me. Rutgers brought in an interesting class. And those Northeastern teams, because UConn also has an interesting class, those are kind of tough, because those schools are kind of taking advantage of the fact that lower division baseball is a big deal in Northeast. Like, D3 baseball is a big deal in Northeast. And they get a lot of players that are super proven from those levels, and you just don't quite know what to do with that. So that is an interesting dynamic there. So those were teams that were kind of in the mix. And I think at the back of this, you start to really see volume in some ways kind of rules the day at the back. You do see smaller classes, shout out Oregon, kind of at the back, but you do start to see more volume plays, most notably with Kansas at 25. And well, you want to talk about just completely starting over from a roster standpoint. And it makes sense. They weren't good last year and they lost most of their best players into the transfer portal before Dan Fitzgerald was even hired at KU. So they needed it and they're getting it. And boy, will that be interesting to watch play out next season, because it is, you talk about classes that are long on projection and short on proven performance. I mean, this is one of them where it's a lot of guys dropping down from Texas and Texas Tech and Tennessee and LSU, and just hoping that a certain number of them are, you know, ready for roles that they weren't going to get in their previous program. So you do start to see more numbers at the back of this thing, because, you know, you start to run short on the high end guys as you get here. So that's where really, you know, there's probably somebody from, you know, 18 to 25 that is going to have a superstar pop, you know, a Sonny DeShera type thing, that is going to look like it was ranked entirely too low. And there's going to be one or more of these massive, massive classes here that are just not going to have much impact at all. And it's just going to be kind of just filler. And then it's going to be a class that probably shouldn't have been ranked. And that's just kind of that's true of recruiting classes as well. And that's just kind of the way this plays out.
Yeah, my recruiting rankings are perfect. that you mentioned about the UConn and Rutgers taking advantage of smaller, lower levels of baseball in the Northeast. And that made me think of Matt Donlin, who was the catcher for UConn this year, who transferred from Stonehill, which I believe is now a Division I school. They're the ones that came up, right? But was a Division II school when he was there. And, you know, he turns out to be, you know, their starting catcher on a super regional team and gets a non-drafted free agent contract with the Red Sox. I mean, so like there are good players to be found there, and UConn has proven adept at that over the years. So it's hard for us to know which players of that are good, but if UConn's finding them, it's generally, I feel good about their talent evaluation of those kinds of players. So definitely a class to watch, because they've been good in the portal before. Like if you go and you look at their team this year, it wasn't just Donlin. You know, Justin Willis came in as a transfer. They have been good at this, and you know, for a program like them, that's been a real advantage for what they've been able to do over the last several years. All right, that's going to do it for us today here on the Baseball America College Podcast. Again, if you want to see the full top 25 of the best transfer classes in the country, that's at baseballamerica.com. Our traditional recruiting rankings are coming, still probably about a week away as you listen to this. I have to finish up my 25. But you can find all of that over at baseballamerica.com. So even though it's the offseason, still plenty to read if you're into the college baseball. And if you're into the pro side, as the minor league season wraps up, there's plenty to read about that as well. You can follow Joe and me on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. Make sure you're subscribed to the podcast, your favorite podcasting app. You can find the Baseball America podcast and hit that subscribe or follow button. And we will continue coming to you once a week throughout the offseason. And next week, we'll get back into our Clubhouse conversation series, I think. Joe and I haven't planned out that far. It should be a return unless we end up talking recruiting rankings. We'll find out. So make sure you're subscribed and you can find the full archives of the Clubhouse conversation series on your favorite podcasting app as well. Until next week, thanks for listening. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you then.